And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The Obama administration released a bunch of memos last week that the Bush administration had kept secret for 8 long years. They were written largely by a former classmate of mine at Yale Law School, currently a professor at University of California, Berkeley, by the name of John Yoo. You may have heard of him. Some of them were also written by Deputy Attorney General Bybee. These memos were largely the foundation of much of the Bush administration's shredding of the Bill of Rights. John Yoo authorizes torture. He doesn't quite call it torture. He merely redefines torture so as not to be things that for generations have been called torture. In a different memo, he authorizes the taking of American citizens and putting them in jail without trial, without counsel, indefinitely. In yet another memo, he authorizes the searching of American citizens' private papers and effects without using a warrant, even though the Fourth Amendment requires that unreasonable searches of a person's papers and effects shall require such a warrant. And you have to, of course, go before a magistrate, a neutral magistrate, a judge, to get that warrant after citing probable cause. So the Fourth Amendment, that thing that prevents unreasonable searches and seizures. The Eighth Amendment, that amendment that prevents excessive punishment, things like torture. The Sixth Amendment, that amendment that protects every American citizen's right to counsel. The Fifth Amendment, that amendment that allows every American due process under the law. Oh, and don't forget the First Amendment, free speech, which in a different memo, John Yoo suggests can be excused in wartime. Let's see, what do we got here? First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, the Seventh Amendment's mostly about civil cases. Let's just say he abolished half the Bill of Rights. We'll give him a little credit for not being too much against people's gun rights. And I got to say, though, the Third Amendment, the one about quartering soldiers in your homes, I would say that his memos come pretty close to that. But we'll only give him credit for five, for abolishing half of the Bill of Rights. Now, for a long time, the defenders of the administration, knowing that these memos were not public, could say things like, well, you know, it's all very complex legal reasoning, you know, it's the kind of thing that you laymen really can't figure out. And it's all in these memos, so don't worry about it. We got it covered. Go away. There's nothing to see here. Run along. But what's fascinating is the lawsuit that helped nudge the Justice Department under President Obama to do the right thing, to release these memos. Because it's brought by a convicted terrorist by the name of Jose Padilla. You may have heard of him. But if not, this amazing battle between Jose Padilla and John Yoo, it just has to be just discussed, because it's a battle that is really, I think, for the heart and soul of the nation. And the two men could not be more different in backgrounds and intentions and views and sanity. Well, I don't know. They may be at the same level of insanity in completely different ways. We'll get to that. But throughout this hour, I want to discuss the John Yoo memos. I don't claim to have read every word of every one of them. I'm working on it, folks. Many of them are long and detailed, and they require me to go through them in detail. So I don't want to pretend that I've read every one of them yet. But I'm working on it, and I'm planning on reading every one of them. And tomorrow, in fact, I've invited Michael Ratner. You may have heard of him. He is one that is from the Center for Constitutional Rights and is actively promoting the idea of going after John Yoo. Whether it be criminally or civilly, I'm not sure. We'll find out from him tomorrow. But someone has already gone after him, and it's Jose Padilla, who has sued John Yoo in a very unusual case. The case seeks monetary damages of $1 and a declaration by the judge that Padilla's constitutional rights were violated. Fascinating suit. It's rare that government officials are sued personally. There is some difficulty, honestly, in Jose Padilla pursuing that suit. But it clearly isn't about money. Despite the fact that Jose Padilla, at least according to his attorneys, was brutally tortured, held in stress positions, left in far excess of heat that most human beings can stand, or cold, left freezing and warm, denied sensory perception. Think about how hard that is. Denied the right to hear or see, shackled at all times. Indeed, this man was left so beaten upon that he was described by one who saw him as a piece of furniture. But let's go back. Let's talk about the history of Jose Padilla and the history of John Yoo and what brings these two very, very different men together in the courtroom. Jose Padilla, let's face it, was pretty much a street thug. Growing up in Chicago, he was a member of several gangs. And indeed, in his youth, before he even reached the age of 18, was convicted of manslaughter for kicking another member of a gang to death. So he's not exactly a gentle soul, granted. But while he was in detention for his earlier crimes, he converted to Islam and he met with a number of people connected to Al-Qaeda. And when he got out, he went to a number of countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, to attend jihad training camps. He changed his name to Jose Ibrahim. He got rid of his first wife, married an Egyptian woman. He seemed to want to pursue that. He arrived back in Chicago Airport, and our government said that he was planning to explode a dirty bomb. A dirty bomb is a radiological bomb. It's sort of a suitcase nuclear weapon. It is an extremely dangerous thing. Not quite as dangerous as Hiroshima or Nagasaki, but still, any nuclear device is an extremely dangerous device. But he was held as a material witness in New York City. Now, material witness is one of those things that is a necessary evil, but is a power that could easily be misused. Basically, when the government holds a material witness, they're holding someone who they haven't accused of a crime, but someone who's so important to prosecuting a crime that the government is afraid to let that person go lest they flee. You can see how dangerous this power is and how easily it could be misused. After all, you're holding an innocent person in jail. That's exactly what you're doing when you hold a material witness. You're holding an innocent person in jail. And so when you do such a thing, it's the kind of power that is very carefully circumscribed and should be circumscribed. You've got to show this person's a flight risk. You've got to show that the crime is extremely important. You've got to show that the information is extremely valuable. Otherwise, we could all be picked up as material witnesses or having seen something. We could all be thrown in prison. Well, that excuse didn't last very long. The courts were quick to show that Jose Padilla was not really being held as a material witness, or at least there wasn't enough grounds to charge him with that. Not that I would mind police or even national security investigators interrogating Jose Padilla on what he saw in Afghanistan and Pakistan and who he talked with. As long as he has the right to counsel and chooses to waive his rights. Heck, you can even force someone to testify as long as you guarantee them no criminal prosecution. You can force someone to basically waive their Fifth Amendment rights. You say, we won't prosecute you for anything criminal you say. It's called limited use immunity. And then you can make the guy talk. And if he doesn't talk, you can throw them in jail until he does. There are ways under the law, without the fancy machinations of John Yoo, to get information from someone who has consorted with dangerous people. We didn't do that. We didn't do that. Instead, George Bush and his lawyers, most notably John Yoo, created a new category. One that had never been used in the law before. Even though we've heard it so much that we think that it actually has some legal basis. Enemy combatant. Sounds familiar, right? I mean, you've heard this term before. You would think this was a common legal term. It sure sounds like a legal term. And indeed, there are legal terms very similar to enemy combatant. There's something called prisoner of war. That's an old term. That prisoner of war has been used long before the United States existed. It's the kind of thing that was codified in Geneva Conventions after World War II, but it existed, Middle Ages, Romans, Greeks. Prisoners of war, that's long-standing international law. Obviously, when you're fighting in a war, you are allowed to capture the other side and hold soldiers prisoner, because if you let them go, they would attack you again. Sounds reasonable. But there's all kinds of international protections you may have heard. You're only allowed to ask name, rank, and serial number, right? Well, that's generally been honored in the breach. Prisoners of war have been asked all kinds of questions, and usually they refuse to answer. You may recall John McCain. Remember him? He ran for president a few months ago. Was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, who pretty much refused to talk. And only when he was tortured signed a statement condemning the United States, which he regretted, and later admitted that, of course, he did not believe. But, you know, when you're tortured, you'd often do and say what people tell you to do and say. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, remember him? The mastermind of September 11th? He may well be. He may well be. I don't know. I wasn't there. But given that he was tortured, it's kind of hard to believe anything the man said. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has, of course, not only confessed after being waterboarded, that special kind of torture developed during the Spanish Inquisition that's been used for centuries, to being not only behind the September 11th attacks, but the World Trade Center bombing, Richard Reed's shoe bombing, which I don't know how he was involved in that one, since it was kind of after he was captured, killing Daniel Pearl. Again, that was significantly after September 11th. Attempted killings of John Paul II, President Clinton, President Musharraf, the 2002 bombing of a Kenya beach resort, nightclub bombings in Bali, Indonesia in 2002, and planned attacks on the Sears Tower, the Empire State Building, the New York Stock Exchange, the Panama Canal, the Big Ben Tower in London, and Heathrow Airport. Was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed behind every single one of those things? I don't know. I mean, it's possible. But it's also possible that he, like John McCain, simply told the people interrogating him and torturing him exactly what they wanted to hear. Which means the information is useless. Indeed, it may be less than useless. Less than useless because if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is taking credit for terrorist attacks that he had nothing to do with, he could actually be masking and protecting the real terrorists who planned these acts. After all, his life is gone. He knows he's going to be executed. He might as well protect his fellow colleagues in terror. And he gets a twofer, right? He tells the interrogators what they want to hear. The torture stops. I guess a threefer. And he protects the people who do the real acts. Which is why whatever you believe about the humanity of torture, and any good liberal will recognize it's not a very humane thing to do. That's the understatement of the century. Practically, the practice is worthless. Less than worthless. See, conservatives pretend that there is this balancing test between the moral horror that goes into our hearts and minds and souls and we have to torture fellow human beings rather than simply, you know, imprison them. I'm okay with imprisoning prisoners of war so they don't attack us again. I'm okay with that. But torture brings it to a new level of horror. And conservatives will tell you there is a balancing test between this moral level of horror and the practical information you get to stop future attacks. But here's the problem. The information you get is less than useless. Not only does it not help because the person tortured will say whatever the interrogators want to hear, but as I pointed out, it actually can mask and hide real terrorist attacks. There is no practical benefit. You've stained your soul. You've bloodied your hands. You've thrown away your entire reservoir of goodwill throughout the world when your nation supports torture, and you don't even get anything for it. So, why did John Yoo authorize torture? We've talked about Jose Padilla, the street thug who went to the Middle East and came back and was accused of trying to set a dirty bomb. But you know what? That accusation was never put forward in any court of law. Was there any reality beyond it? I don't know. Kind of doubt it. You think if there were, it would have been brought up as some kind of evidence. So Jose Padilla, we're going to get to John Yoo in a minute. Jose Padilla comes back, held for material witness for about a month. Then he's held as an enemy combatant pursuant to John Yoo's memos. Kept for 3, 4, 5 years without access to, actually at least 3 years without access to a lawyer. And then lawyers sued on his behalf. And went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. Lower court said he had right to the lawyers. Lower court said he had a right to challenge his detention. Lower court said he had a right to habeas corpus. And the Supreme Court first considered his case in 2004. And they punted. And I think those scholars are right who say that the United States Supreme Court punted because they didn't want to say this stuff was legal, but at the same time they didn't want to really hit the Bush administration too hard. It was like a warning. They got off on a technicality. The Supreme Court said in 2004 that because Padilla was being held in South Carolina and because the suit was brought against authorities in New York, where he was first detained, well, there was a venue problem. Do it over. Try again. Go to South Carolina. Get out of the liberalish Second Circuit Court of Appeals and go to the most conservative Court of Appeals in the country, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that handles South Carolina, where you have a whole bunch of George Bush appointees who will do what Bush wants. I'm confident the U.S. Supreme Court, while not wanting to allow the federal government to torture and hold American prisoners for all time of American citizens without a trial, they didn't really want to eviscerate the Bill of Rights, at the same time wanted to give the Bush administration a really friendly court in the hope that they could just not take the case up anymore, let it go away. Maybe Bush would do the right thing. They went to the Fourth Circuit. And the Fourth Circuit went too far and said he could be held without trial. And it was going up to the Supreme Court again, and the Bush administration knew that this time the Supreme Court would have no choice but to rebuke that circuit, so they made the case moot. They said, you know what, after 5 years of holding him as an enemy combatant, we can try him in U.S. courts. Yeah, that thing about we couldn't try him in U.S. courts, that was silly, and all those dirty bomb allegations, kind of ridiculous. We're going to try him in Miami, and we're going to prove that, yes, he did go and consort with some people in Al-Qaeda. And even though they didn't really have a plan to bomb anything, they kind of had a plan to make an agreement to later make a plan to bomb something. And even though conspiracy law requires not only that you make a plan to do a bad act, but that you actually do it or take a start at it, at least prepare to do something bad. I guess that's to prevent a bunch of kids high in a basement who plot to kill the president from... But actually don't do anything about it, they're not guilty. You have to do something. But using these wide standards, there was enough. And, you know, Jose Padilla is not exactly the nicest guy in the world, or at least he wasn't, who knows, before his torture. And he was sentenced to 17 years. And just last week, he brought a lawsuit against John Yoo. So let's talk about John Yoo, the other person in this great battle between one of the poorest and it's hard to describe. How do you describe Jose Padilla? Let's just say between someone from the wrong side of the tracks and someone from the right side of the tracks. John Yoo is an immigrant from South Korea. He did very well in school. I know him personally. He went to Harvard undergrad, degree in history, went to Yale Law School. He was there when I was. I had some classes with him. I had some discussions with him. We used to argue over lunch from time to time. He was always carrying the water of the Federalist Society and the right-wing conservatives there. And he was hired by the Bush administration at the Office of Legal Counsel, the Justice Department, to basically justify what they wanted to do. And John Yoo went after that with aplomb. I asked earlier in the hour, how did he justify torture? You probably are aware of the John Yoo standard for torture, the kind that says it requires sort of serious impairment to bodily functions. You basically have to destroy a bodily function or an organ. And if you don't permanently destroy some bodily function, you know, you break a bone, bones heal, right? So you haven't probably destroyed anything. Maybe cutting off an arm would be too bad, but merely cutting it and putting it back together, you haven't destroyed the arm. You might want to know where those standards came from. Well, I've been reading John Yoo's memo, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating, the leap of legal illogic. I got to tell you, it reminds me much more of when I used to read Bush v. Gore, the legal case that I probably read more times than any other in my life. But I, with all due immodesty, I've been considered somewhat of an expert on. The Congressional Black Caucus hired me to challenge the fraud electors based on my writings on Bush v. Gore. Well, John Yoo's memos remind me of Bush v. Gore. Do you know how he got to this idea that torture is not torture unless you have a permanent impairment of some bodily function? I'll tell you. The Geneva Conventions prohibit severe pain. The United Nations Convention Against Torture. This is something the United States signed. We're a signatory. It's a treaty, and under the Constitution, treaties are the law of the land. In fact, they're the supreme law of the land. They're actually more powerful even than congressional laws. Just defines torture as severe pain. We can't have severe pain. But how do you define severe? Well, you and I think, know what severe means. It's really harsh pain. It's got nothing to do with impairment of bodily functions. It's just really, really bad pain. Like the kind in waterboarding, for example. But John Yoo, listen to this. John Yoo looked long and hard in every statute. He must have used the Lexis computer search to find another statute that defines severe pain. He didn't know what it meant. The United Nations Convention Against Torture, of course, was signed by more than 100 nations. It's something that there's certainly lots of data in the United Nations legislative history. That's where you would go. That's where I would go, good lawyer, to interpret a statute. He didn't look at the UN Convention Against Torture. He didn't look at their documents. I guess, or maybe he looked and didn't like what he found, which is more likely. He went to U.S. statutes. Maybe he looked under torture statutes in America. Maybe he looked under Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, that amendment of the Constitution that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Couldn't find anything he liked there. Looked under criminal law. Looked under violent abuse statutes, perhaps police misconduct statutes. Couldn't find anything he liked there. Well, now he's in a real bind. He's got to justify torture. Cheney's already authorized the waterboarding, probably, or is about to. He's got to find a way to justify torture, and he can't find anything in international law, United Nations law, in American criminal law, in American military law. After all, our military commissions, you know, our military follows the Geneva Conventions and is taught to. He's got to find a way around a treaty. So he goes to, get this. He goes to the Medicare bill. Medicare. Which isn't normally what you think of when you think about torture, but you know, you do a Lexis search and you type in severe pain and it pops up every time it's ever used in U.S. law. He goes to 42 U.S.C. section 1395, the thing that regulates insurance benefits under the Medicare plan. And the Medicare plan defines an emergency medical condition, which it has to because, you know, if you have an emergency, you can go to any hospital and get it fixed and you don't have to worry about getting pre-approval or anything like that. It's an emergency. It's a medical condition. That's important. And Medicare says that emergency medical condition is one, quote, manifesting itself by acute symptoms of sufficient severity, including severe pain, that a prudent layman could reasonably expect that without immediate medical treatment, the individual displaying those symptoms would be at serious risk of losing their health, suffering serious impairment to bodily functions, or suffering serious dysfunction of any bodily organ or part. So Medicare says that if you're going to lose a bodily function, you're going to lose an organ, or you have severe pain, then you know what? You can get covered. Great. I'm a big fan of Medicare. John Yoo took this statute, the one defining an emergency medical condition under Medicare, he took this statute and said, well, this statute is talking about severe pain as an indicator of some kind of permanent or serious damage in the absence of medical treatment. So therefore, death, organ failure, permanent impairment of a significant bodily function. That must be what severe pain means under the UN Convention Against Torture. Got it? Did you follow that logic? Because if you did, I think you need serious mental help. The fact that Medicare talks about an emergency medical condition as including severe pain or impairment of bodily function caused John Yoo to suggest that we can cause anything except impairing a medical function, even though we're a signatory to a treaty that prevents severe pain. I'm embarrassed that I went to law school with this guy. Obviously, logic wasn't one of his strong suits. And yet, it's really all very understandable. When you're in an administration that fixes the facts around the policy, when you're in an administration that fixes the law around the policy, fixing the facts around the policy, of course, is from the famous Downing Street memo. This is an administration that makes policy first and finds facts and law to justify it later. And sometimes when you do something blatantly illegal and blatantly unlawful, you've got to jump through 28 hoops, ride a few imaginary unicorns, before you can find a way to justify the unjustifiable. Leave it to John Yoo to find an obscure Medicare statute defining benefits to trump the UN Convention Against Torture. I'm sure he truly believes that Congress, when it passed the Medicare law, when Congress passed Medicare, clearly Congress had in their mind that they were going to justify torture. Right? Right, John Yoo? That's your argument? There's a lot more than that. There's a lot more memos, and of course it is coming to a head in the infamous case of Padilla v. Yoo, which I am following and which we're going to talk about even more tomorrow with constitutional law scholar Michael Ratner. Let me take a break, give you a chance to call in if you have any questions on what I've just said or anything else regarding John Yoo and his infamous memo. 877-4HEAD-ON, 877. We got a call here. All right. Bob has told me, sorry. See, I was about to go on a break, but I've just been told by Bob to not take a break because he's taking some phone calls about his son, and I think we can all hope that Ferg gets well very quickly. I'll go ahead. I'll take my break later. I'm not sure if Bob's. See if you can call in and you want to call in, go ahead. And if you can't get through, we'll just go on without you. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. It's not just the torture memo. I kind of wish it was. I kind of wish there was just one memo that blatantly ignored logic to justify the unjustifiable, to excuse the unexcusable. But of course, there's a lot more. In the case of Padilla, he's actually not suing because of his treatment. He was held in stress positions. He was subject to extreme heat. He was subject to extreme cold. That's not why he's suing. And indeed, his lawsuit has trouble. I mean, let's face it. Generally, you have to sue the person who did it to you, not the lawyers who justified it. Although in the Nuremberg cases, it should be noted that the Nazi lawyers that justified Nazi treatment were put on trial. No, he's suing for the fact that John Yoo and his memos justified holding him in jail incommunicado without a lawyer, without charging him with a crime. And again, I think it's vital to point out that I'm not saying Jose Padilla is a nice guy, or I want him as my neighbor, or I would trust him with a family member. I have no doubt that this is a man who, even before we mistreated him, was dangerous. But you see, I'm not defending Jose Padilla. I am defending the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I think our country, our system of justice, is strong enough that we could have tried Jose Padilla and put him in jail using something called due process. A lawyer giving him all his rights under the law, evidence that comes out in the courtroom, legal interrogations, a jury, and a verdict. And indeed, it appears that happened in Miami. And I didn't follow that case very closely, I admit it. I don't, you know, but The jury of 12 seemed to believe that Jose Padilla, while having nothing to do with the dirty bomb, deserved to go to jail. Fine. Why couldn't that trial have been done 5 years ago? Why was it so important to have a government lawyer eviscerate our Bill of Rights if we could have tried Jose Padilla and put him in jail and been done with it? Why was it so important? Well, maybe because this administration feared something worse. Or maybe it's because this administration looked forward to something worse, hoped for the kind of crisis that would allow them to take over with even more powers. One of John Yoo's memos, and I'm pulling it up here. This is why I wanted the break, so I could get this stuff a little bit ready for you in advance. But one of his memos says that even free speech can be stopped in America. See, there are laws that prohibit the United States military taking law enforcement action. They're actually very, very old laws. There's a law from 1807, the Insurrection Act, that says basically that, state authorities, they're the ones who have to take care of problems. That it's not the role of the military to do law enforcement. And this was even more clear in the Posse Comitatus Act. The Posse Comitatus Act, interestingly, has a very bad history. What's a posse? A posse is, you may remember from the movies of the Old West, it's when the sheriff says to the citizens, "Hey, come on out, we've got to catch a criminal." Posse comitatus means hue and cry in Latin. And the sheriff cries, "I don't have enough men to capture this varmint, this outlaw, so I need you all to get on your horses and help capture the guy." The problem with posses is that, well, when you have the government take a bunch of ordinary citizens who don't have any training and give them guns and tell them to go after people, there tends to be riots and a lot of danger. They can go amok. You can have lynchings. And ironically, the Posse Comitatus Act was designed to prevent the federal authorities from doing some good things after the Civil War. You may know that after the Civil War, the disputed election of 1876, there was a compromise, and the compromise was we will allow the Republican to take power, even though he lost the election. Hayes lost the election to Samuel Tilden. And in return, will remove the federal troops from the South after the Civil War. And the South wanted to make sure the federal troops wouldn't come back in and protect things like, ex-slaves' rights. So they passed the Posse Comitatus Act, which, even though it has a inglorious beginning, basically says, hey, it ain't the role of the U.S. military to enforce state laws. That yes, the military can fight wars, but you don't need a military to take one man, Jose Padilla, or even another man, Yasser Hamdi. It doesn't take the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, to take these two men, to put them in prison, to charge them with a crime, and to get them convicted or acquitted by a jury of their peers. Just doesn't take that. Well, did you know that this act, which actually I think probably sounds intuitive for you, this act was abolished by the Republican Congress in 2006? Both Posse Comitatus Act and Insurrection Act were just thrown away. The Bush administration was given the power to go in and use the military and arrest people at will and throw them in jail and do whatever they want in the war against terrorism. This was all stuck in some little notice piece of the 500 billion added to fighting the wars in the ending days of the Republican Congress in 2006. Now, luckily, it was noticed when the Democrats took over Congress, and they did repeal it in 08. So we have the old laws as we did before. But this shows, totally apart from John Yoo, the determination of the Bush administration to extend its powers to the broadest extent they could, to the extent of the Constitution, even beyond the Constitution. And so John Yoo was ready. He was ready, for example, to abolish the Bill of Rights, to abolish the First Amendment if necessary, arguing that in times of war, the government can do whatever it wants, can even abolish the First Amendment. I'd like to take a break and see if I can get some of these memos up here on the screen. But I can't tell whether... All right, let's take a quick break, and I'll be right back. I want to get these memos before you so I can cite the exact language. 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner went on Charlie Rose and didn't exactly knock me over. He said the Obama administration is moving as quickly with as much force as comprehensively as possible to address the financial crisis. But the truth is that Obama and Geithner lowballed the economic stimulus package, and that's going to come a cropper. Geithner also said over and over again that the Obama administration was going to solve the banking crisis and get credit moving again, but he's yet to announce the details of that plan, and what little he does say about it doesn't make sense to me. Rather than just biting the bullet and nationalizing some of these big banks, he said he and Obama are prepared to give them basically as much money as they need to keep operating. From a strictly business standpoint, this is foolish because we could buy these banks outright for a lot less than we're paying them to stay afloat. On top of that, Geithner said again that the government will be subsidizing private investors to buy up some of the bank's bad assets. Why should we be paying for vulture capitalists to pick over the carcasses of these banks? Geithner did make one telling concession. He noted that we have 9,000 banks in this country, but the top 20 account for between two-thirds and three-quarters of our banking system. If that's not a case for breaking these banks up, I don't know what is. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I've been reading the memos of my law school colleague, John Yu. And I have to say, as I read them, it pains me when I recognize that someone I went to school with could do so much damage in so little time. And it makes me wonder if, if I or others like me were put in the right position, we could do a lot of good in the same period of time. As I read the justifications of John Yu, though, I have to realize, I recognize that he's really a cog in a larger wheel. As much as we can complain about him and should complain about him, he was doing what his bosses wanted him to do. If he had not done so, he surely would have been fired. So while he is and was and continues to be a true believer, someone who wrote recently in the Wall Street Journal that if we'll just read his memos, we'll understand all the logic behind what he has to say, that he says that, people on the anti-war left have never read his memos. Well, now we have his memos and we can read them and we can see that he would fail an elementary attempt at logic. But I found the memo that I was looking for in the break. It was the one that talks about when you can abolish free speech. Because most of us know about his views on torture, his views on the Fourth Amendment prohibition against illegal searches and seizures. But did you know in his October 23rd memorandum he said, quote, First Amendment speech and press rights may also be subordinated to the overriding need to wage war successfully? And that the current campaign against terrorism may require even broader exercises of federal power domestically? Now, why is it important for the federal government to prevent press domestically in its terror campaign? I mean, I could see an argument. And I think it's one that, frankly, I'm not so sure about. But I can see an argument that if we're on the battlefield in Pakistan or Afghanistan, that we could say to the press, hey, don't report on where our movements are. I can see that. Don't say where our military is going or that we plan an attack on this particular terrorist target on this particular day. If you find out, please keep quiet because it will alert the terrorists and they'll be able to prevent the attack. I understand that kind of military necessity. I do. In fact, what's interesting is that where the United States has asked people in the press to keep quiet, they often do. They don't have to, as we learned in the infamous Pentagon Papers case back in the 1970s when the New York Times discovered the secret bombing of Cambodia, which always astonishes me, because you know what? The people of Cambodia didn't think it was a secret. They knew they were being bombed. It was only a secret of people in the United States, and they printed it. And in a very famous case, the Pentagon Papers case, went up before the United States Supreme Court, they said that, look, when a reporter finds out information that someone should not have disclosed to them, it's not the press's fault. In other words, this is an important principle, and it comes up in all kinds of contexts that you wouldn't expect it. But if somebody has a security clearance and they disclose classified information, they could be in real trouble. But if they disclose it to a journalist and the journalist repeats it, it's not the journalist's fault. Classic case, of course, is Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney and Valerie Plame Wilson, right? Cheney had a security clearance. Libby had a security clearance. They disclosed that Valerie Plame Wilson, wife of Ambassador Joe Wilson, was a spy. In doing so, they, in my humble opinion, committed treason. After all, George Bush Sr. said that the outing of a CIA agent is one of the most traitorous acts that can be committed. But Robert Novak, and I'm no friend of Robert Novak, right-wing journalist, when he passed on the word, was he acting unethically? I think so. Did he commit treason? No. Did he break the law? No. No, Cheney did. Libby did. It's not Novak's fault. As much as I dislike Novak, I agree, you can't criminally prosecute him. The same is true with Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. Maybe the people who told Daniel Ellsberg we were bombing Cambodia, maybe they broke the law. But Ellsberg didn't, because he didn't have a security clearance. He didn't have an obligation to keep that secret. Interestingly, there's a case right now that shows the exact same thing with AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, where apparently some people in the government told them some secrets, and they spread it around. They told the press. They told people in Israel, and they're being prosecuted for it. That case will lose, too, under the same principles. You may not like that they did it, but when you are given secret information and you have no obligation to keep it a secret, it's not your fault if you tell people. The press is allowed to do its work. However, when the press has been asked not to spread the word, they often don't. They often don't. The New York Times was asked not to talk about the secret memos that allowed us to spy. Well, it didn't allow us to spy because it's not constitutionally allowed, but that purported to authorize the Bush administration to spy on hundreds of millions of Americans in the secret surveillance program. They kept it quiet for a year. And they did so not because they had any legal obligation to. I've just pointed out, when you don't have a security clearance and you're the press, the people who disclose it to you can get in trouble, but you can't, you're not in trouble. Basic law, basic constitutional law. Yet they kept it secret. They kept it secret because the administration asked them to, and they did. So let's go back to John Yoo. Should the press keep military things we do secret? Yeah, I think they should. But are they required by law to? No, they're not. And I think that the press, in its role as the fourth estate, should recognize the difference between military necessity and something that actually endangers all of us as Americans. There is a vast difference, between outing the name of a CIA agent, giving her name, risking lives, and announcing that we're secretly bombing Cambodia. There is a vast difference between disclosing a specific military operation in a way that could endanger lives and simply disclosing that the administration is spying on hundreds of millions of Americans, right? Secret bombing of Cambodia, the press should disclose. They're not disclosing a specific bombing at a specific time endangering a specific individual. They're letting Americans know what the policy is, even though they shouldn't disclose the specific military adventure. And while I do think that, outing a CIA agent, that's not something good. Novak should not have done that. He had the right to, but he shouldn't have done it. It did no good except for, fulfill a political agenda. I do think you should disclose when hundreds of millions of Americans, 99.9999% of us innocent, are being spied upon. You see, it's really not that hard a rule to enforce, even though it's the press's choice. They can't get in trouble for spreading information that was leaked to them. Just the leaker can get in trouble. So I bring all this up to note that when John Yoo says that military necessity is necessary to stop the First Amendment, generally I find the press errs on the wrong side. They actually disclose too little. I am not aware of a case where the press has disclosed a military operation when asked not to that endangered lives, with the exception, I guess, of Robert Novak. Maybe John Yoo was talking to Robert Novak. Maybe John Yoo really felt that Novak shouldn't be allowed to spread Cheney's outing of CIA agents. Maybe he was referring to him. I don't think so, though. In any case, the First Amendment can be circumscribed. We've talked about the Eighth Amendment, torture. The Sixth Amendment, that's holding someone in jail without trial. Up right now, Padilla VU is exactly the case that forced, or let's just say encouraged, the Justice Department to disclose all these memos. And it may shock you to know that the Obama administration, at least thus far, is defending the position of John Yoo. No, they're not defending, I want to be clear, they're not defending John Yoo's memos on torture or the abolishment of the First Amendment or holding people in jail without trial. No, no. Attorney General Eric Holder is very clear that he has repudiated all of those things. Indeed, many of the Bush administration had even repudiated these things before Attorney General Holder became Attorney General. But they are defending Yoo's right as a government employee not to be sued. And that's okay. That's a separate issue. I kind of get it. You don't want to be sued just for expressing a legal opinion. I get that. But I don't think John Yoo was just expressing a legal opinion. I mean, if there are two... Look, I'm a lawyer. Lots of the law is ambiguous. Plenty of the law you can argue two different ways. Or just look at even treaties. Look at the anti-ballistic missile treaty with the Soviet Union. You could argue that now the Soviet Union doesn't exist, we don't have to abide by that treaty. That's actually, I think, a fair argument. You can also argue that since Russia is a successor to the Soviet Union, we do have to abide by that treaty. I think that's a fair argument, too. You can argue it either way. And a lawyer that made an argument either way should never be prosecuted. But I think there's a limit. I think when you define torture as not being torture, based not on the treaty and not on the UN Convention Against Torture and not on Geneva Conventions and not on criminal law and not on wartime law, but on an obscure Medicare benefit statute, you've gone beyond a good faith interpretation of an ambiguous law. You've gone clear over to frivolousness, clear over to the kind of justification that's no justification at all. I hope that the Justice Department, upon reviewing these memos, and you know, they've only been in power 50 days, and they're very busy with the economy and other things. I don't know that they've, you know, even have staffed it enough to read all these memos. But I hope they'll recognize at some point a government lawyer is acting outside the law. At some point, a government lawyer is acting outside the purview of the administration. When it is give, you know, when you give a law interpretation, there are realms within ambiguity, and then there's way outside. And John Yoo did not even give a colorable version of the law. So I hope that the Obama administration will allow this lawsuit to proceed. And I think Padilla should win. He'll win $1, and he'll win something far more valuable. A declaration by a court that the United States, under John Yoo, violated the constitutional rights of Jose Padilla. It's too late to help Jose Padilla, this ex-thug. Really not about him. It's about all of us and protecting the Bill of Rights for the future. I hope that Jose Padilla wins his case against John Yoo, and I'll be watching it carefully in the days to come. Tomorrow I've got Michael Radoff. He is the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's been working on this case and prosecuting people like John Yoo. And you'll hear from him. Don't miss tomorrow's Inside Scoop. Right now we have Bob Kincaid, your hillbilly elitist, right after this. This is Mark Levine signing off.